fellow travelers, and welcome to the Traversing the Stars podcast. How are my loyal listeners? Thank you for your continued support. And as always, hit that subscribe button, everybody. We have an amazing show for y'all, because aboard the mothership is Jane Lohman. She's an acclaimed television and film producer. Now she's producing The Swearing Jar, starring Kathleen Turner, Patrick J. Adams, and David Hewlett. Now come aboard as we go traversing the stars. Hello, Miss Lohman. Thank you so much for coming to Traversing the Stars podcast.
Why, thank you so much for inviting me.
It's totally my honor. It's a pleasure to talk with you. I feel like I'm talking to almost the entire family so far.
I know, right? You talked to Kate and David, right?
Yeah. So now I got you. I got the whole triangle.
That's great. Yes. Yes. Well, that's wonderful. I mean, you know, we are, it's an informal family business. We all do our, it's just good to know really talented, creative people who you can blackmail into doing stuff because they owe you.
Well, I think it's great to see a family work on a project like this. I mean, there's got to be a certain level of, you know, trust and connection to do something like this, and a huge amount of patience, I imagine.
Maybe a little. Yeah, I mean, I think it's great to come by these things, honestly. And they're just super talented. I don't think I'd choose to work with family if they weren't all so good at what they do. Mm. And David is an incredible creative force and an amazing actor and director and just visionary. And I admire everything he does, and I want to cast him in everything that I do, because then I know I'm going to have at least one cast member who shows up on time and knows all their lines. And Kate is equally an amazing actor and also this fantastic writer who this script for The Swearing Jar is just one of the most beautiful things I've read. And I was talking to some industry folk in the distribution and sales side last weekend, and we were joking about how important it is for the script to read well and to be well written, as well as a good script, which doesn't sound like it should be a different thing. To me, when I first saw the section in the bookstore that said literary fiction, I thought, how is all fiction not literary? But you kind of get used to a certain level of, like, this just gets the story out, and then these books are just you're reading for the sheer word.
Yeah.
See, I'm running out of vocabulary myself. But
the difference between a beach read and a school read.
100%. But school read makes it sound like a duty. And I've just always really been drawn to literature that's challenging. So anyway, to come back to the script, Kate's script is absolutely beautifully written. Every conversation, every bit of dialogue, every lyric of the song, they're all incredible. And it may not have made for the easiest sell in the development process, because I think some people were assessing it on a different level and not really getting into that. But now the response to the film has been, oh my God, what an amazing script. How on earth was that hard to sell? The script's just perfect. And I'm like, Yeah, it was pretty great to start with. And then also Lindsay, our director, did a really amazing job with the editor, also a Lindsay, in just honing it and just really focusing the stories.
I must say, it's funny. The director's last name is McKay. I was thinking of David Hewlett's character, McKay, that it kind of all connects with this movie.
They were I'm a big believer in serendipity. Not in a particularly religious way, but I've always believed in things working out. It's when you disconnect it from religion, I don't know quite how to explain it, but I feel like some things happen the way they're meant to. And this film for every single peak and valley of the roller coaster ride that it's been in getting it to camera and now out to audiences. There's some element of serendipity about all of it. And with Lindsay McKay, yeah, I mean, there's the McKay thing, which is quite fun to acknowledge. But also, equally, if we hadn't taken so long to go to camera, she would not have been available to us. You know, she was somebody that I've known of her work since Wet Bum in 2014, and I met her perhaps 2015, 2016, when she's working with a really good friend of mine on their next feature, and really, really wanted to work with her. But then when I needed a director in 2017, she was definitely not available to me. When we finally got financed in 2020, some things happened, and the director that we had been working with was then not available, and all of this was happening as COVID was happening, and we were trying to work to a schedule that didn't account for the pandemic that was about to hit us. So but things shifted and we needed a director, and Lindsay was available, and so it just did all work out in a very serendipitous way. And I couldn't be happier.
Well, talk about serendipity, because I mean, I did some research into you and your background. For someone who's in, you know, a producer and with films, I read that you grew up above Westminster Theatre.
That's right. Yeah.
Now, how did growing up above a theater inspire your future career path now? Because it feels like, talk about serendipity, that someone who lives above a theater was just born to be in film and tell stories.
That probably is true. I was definitely always close to the arts world. The reason we lived above the theater was my dad was the theater manager, and my mom ran the restaurant. But neither of them came from an arts background. My dad got into theater and the arts after the Second World War. He was always on the practical, logistical side of things, and he got involved with the touring theatre company. And they also made films. So he was doing it, but really always from a practical approach. And then he moved, he was brought to London by the same company because they bought this theatre and started putting on plays. And so he was a go-to person for working that out. But for me, I grew up being absolutely entranced by the creation of the art, not always the material itself, but certainly how it was done. And so I went to art college for a year and was following a path into fashion, and then went to work for the summer in a theater in Switzerland that was connected to the one I grew up with in. And it was volunteer work, but I was handed the script and told I was stage managing and here's how you do the book. And it just all came a lot more naturally to me than the fashion that I'd been pursuing. And so at that point, I made the sort of career swerve back into the art that I'd grown up surrounded by. But I've always been a movie buff. Like, theater actually puts me to sleep. I love it. But there's something about the warm cocoon space with the live actors breathing that sends me off into, you know, like a narcolepsy. Whereas with film, it's, I don't know, there's something just that bit more in your face. So film was always my fantasy, but theater was what I knew. So when I decided to pursue that, I went to university so that I understood the text, because I felt like I knew how to put the production together. Like, on the practical side, I could do that stuff. I just wanted to be able to understand what I was doing it for. So went to university there, got into film from a critical angle, and it just all kind of, serendipity, fluke. I came back to London after university, was looking for work in the industry and would have taken anything that was available, and was offered one day on a commercial or a week on a show, TV show called Movies, Games and Videos, which was a family entertainment show that literally ran down the week's movies, games and videos that were coming out. So we were one of the first TV shows about the games industry, which helps me with cred with my 15-year-old son, because I know an awful lot about games, even though I'm not a gamer. And it also allowed me to fully understand how films are put together. I got to interview a lot of people behind the scenes, a lot of actors and directors and producers, and also knew how they were marketed, because that was our end of the industry. So that's what took me to LA. And then when David was cast on Stargate, that was when I took a bit of a break from entertainment TV, and we were like, what should we do now? And so we decided to write a movie. And we worked through a couple of different scripts and concepts before we came across The Dog's Breakfast, before we came up with The Dog's Breakfast. But yeah, that was my first venture into movie making. And at that point, it just felt like, oh, so this is what I've been training for. It's the practical, the production side, figuring out how all the elements come together. It's the creative, figuring out what story you want to tell, and the aesthetic and the casting and, you know, the vision for it. And then it's getting it out there into the world. The only thing that we didn't have to do on A Dog's Breakfast that I've spent much more time doing since is the financing. So that was the piece. But now I feel like a hardened pro, and I get really granular really quickly if anyone asks me about tax credit.
So one thing that's kind of interesting is that you mentioned that you, when you went to University of Aberdeen, you went for, or you did some film criticism.
Yes. Yes. It was an English degree, but they introduced the film course while I was there. So I took all of them.
So how do you think understanding what, or looking at a movie or film from an analytical standpoint helps you now as a producer, as you're analyzing what needs to be, what needs to exist in a film for it to work properly?
That's a really good question. I mean, to me, when I'm pitched film ideas, my instinct is to go, I'm instantly drawn to something that I can visualize me being able to make in a very practical sense. But then the other side of the coin that has to also click is it a story I want to tell? You know, people on the creative side of the industry, are very passionate and charming and inspiring people generally. And so you can get really, really swept up with this, like the passion of their pitch. And then I think, yeah, but I don't want to tell that story. And I think that's just, it comes down to trusting yourself ultimately. Film criticism, I think, really helped me understand the director's art, the cinematographer's art, the screenwriter's art, the art of it, and also what appeals to me, which isn't, and recognizing that's a very personal thing. I am drawn. I wrote my college dissertation on Tim Burton.
Awesome.
And he's amazing. He's a genius. But I think perhaps he would allow for the fact that some of his films are much, much more about the visuals than they are about the story. Maybe they don't start out that way, but ultimately, you know, you kind of have to let him off the hook for some logic gaps or some not necessarily fully rounded characters, or, you know, just some jumps in the storytelling, because you can be so swept up in his in his world creation. So to me, that's always really important. Equally, I mean, I guess the creators, the directors I tend to think of as ones that I love, which I know isn't what you asked me, but sort of speaks to that what I learned in college, are people like Baz Luhrmann and Tim Burton, Soderbergh too, who have a style and a panache and a confidence that really appeal. I think it really helps that, going back to what I learned at college, I think it really helped me understand how you could weave a deeper meaning into a narrative that some people will get, some people may not, but hopefully they enjoy the movie on whatever level they approach it. And I think that definitely pertains to how we put together the swearing jar, because, you know, I felt this, that we had the script down, like that told the story, and it was a story I wanted to tell. It was about a woman in her, a place in her life where she thinks she's got it all together, and then some things happen that make her realize that she didn't, and that maybe that's never possible. But that doesn't mean you don't try, and it also doesn't mean that you failed if that's the case. And so I really felt that the script was solid, and then finding Lindsay, I knew that the visual aesthetic and the way that she told the story would be super solid. And then it was just down to casting, and we held out to make sure that that was all taken care of too, that there's no weak links. The performances are all incredible and perfect for the role, and that maybe wasn't the most commercial decisions that we could have made along the way, but it was really important to us. So, yeah.
Now, as the producer, now I think people in my end of the world, which is basically just people who watch movies and think they're awesome, when they think producer, they usually, I think the misconception is that a producer is the one who just pays for things.
Yes.
Now, what is the role of producer beyond that aspect?
I was once on a short film, and the craft service guy asked me what a producer did, and I said everything that no one else wants to do or no one else gets paid to do. And on a short film, when nobody's getting paid, I would do the things that I couldn't bring myself to ask somebody else to do. So the next day he came in early. We were both the first people to set. And I had rubber gloves and a toilet brush, and I was unplugging the porta potty that was our resource. Glamorous. And he's like, "Okay, now I believe you." That's not obviously the case on a production that, you know, like the Swearing Jar, where we, you know, we had a small but decent budget, and we got to pay people for their work, I think, you know, at a decent level. From my perspective, I mean, there's three main roles in producing, and not every producer does every part of it. the executive producers are the ones who are putting up the money. The producers are the ones who have persuaded them to do that. So there's the finding and the gathering and the securing of the money. In order to successfully do that, the producer has to have the creative material, the creative vision, and have assembled the creative team. So, you know, you have to have the passion for the project. You have to be able to convey that. And you have to bring those people on board and put them together in the right way so that everything meshes and you deliver on your vision and what you promised to the exec producers who put up the money. And then there's also the practical on set, keeping the wheels turning, keeping everybody on track. You have a production manager or a line producer who is fantastic. I mean, if you're lucky and you have a bit of budget anyway, that's then the production manager is the person who's hiring the crew and dealing with payroll and accounting and invoicing and all of that. On the micro budget films, as producer, I have fetched lunch, run craft service, being the script consultant, coordinator, being a locations manager, and a cable runner, and a few other things in between as well. But yeah, the producer, in a way, is behind everything, which makes you not the first person. Or it makes you first person in the line of fire, but it makes you not, you know, you answer all the questions that nobody else wants to answer. Does that make sense? Does that help?
Oh no!
So you've got your money, your creative, and your practical, are the three angles of the three branches of producing. And I like to do all of them. I love the creative. I am very I get very dug in on the practical, and I am very happy to talk in general terms about the money. But one of the things that I hate doing is actually asking for it. So I team up with good people for that.
Well,
Well,
one interesting thing about the producer is, when you're looking at the creative process of making a film, you have a director who has a vision, a screenwriter who has a vision, the actors who have a vision of their own characters, and you have a vision, and you have to make a decision as to how much involved you want to get on any one particular person's vision and how much you can step on their toes or how much you need to back off. How hard is it to make those decisions? How bad is it to, or tempting is it to jump in and be like, no, 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 this is what I want, because I'm the guy in charge, you know?
That's a really good question, because to a degree, I would say I'm loath to do that because I've hired people that I trust, and I hope that we've had enough discussions leading up to that. It's never something, it should never be something that happens on the day. But then that said, like, there are times when, you know, you're on set and you are surprised by the way something's going and it's not quite how you'd visualized it. And then I think my approach is to step back and see where it's going, whether it's a performance thing or a directorial thing. If it surprises me, maybe that's a good thing. And if I discover it, if ultimately it surprises me in a bad way, then I think I will step in. But fortunately, I mean, I've been very lucky not to have that happen too often. I think it's collaboration is the key and communication. I mean, I will say on Swearing Jar, having COVID restrictions that meant that we couldn't all be in room together in the prep period did make things difficult. Every time we did have a conversation, things came up that seemed surprising to somebody, you know, not necessarily me, but you know, the conversations are so important, and it is great to be able to collaborate from the earliest get-go. And that was just a little tricky because we all got on set and were like, hi, for the first time. I mean, for Addie and Patrick, who were playing this married, long, familiar, 12 years together couple, you know, they had one day on set to familiarize themselves with each other and with their home, you know, while it was being set up, because it was the production manager, the production designer rather, who was, you know, doing their work while we were on set rehearsing. So it's always a challenge, but they're true professionals who rolled with it. And I think their chemistry on screen is incredible and nobody would know. So, yeah.
So having talked to Kate Hewlett, talking to you, it was a long process getting this movie made. Lot of roadblocks, a lot of difficulties. What kept you believing in the project and saying, this is going to happen? I'm confident I can make this happen.
Wow. Belief in the script, for sure. Belief that there's an audience out there for grown-up stories about grown-up women. Just really feeling like it was such a beautiful story. It didn't make any sense to me that it shouldn't get told. I really wanted to honor and treasure Kate's script and the genesis of it. The music is amazing. And I guess along the way, we brought people on board that I wanted to work with. And so the idea of that not happening was too much to bear. And I guess at some point too, you're just like, wow, I've dedicated enough time to this. If I give up now, I guess I'm a bit determined and persistent. And I wasn't going to let this go, you know. Kind of like our dog and her squishmallow that she adores. I think even when there were times when it did all look like it was going completely pear-shaped, I was just like, nope, gonna just move on and keep going. There's a level of, I was not in the context of this film, but the next one that I was just pitching recently, I just feel like, come on, who doesn't want to make this, you know, like, and hopefully now, because we've done the Swearing Jar and we've shown what we can do and how beautiful it can be, hopefully now my incredulity that anyone could not want to make it will be translated into them kind of going, yeah, she says so, maybe. We'll see. We'll see.
Well, one of the coolest castings in the movie is Kathleen Turner, who's an absolute legend in film. So you guys share that story. How did she get involved? And once she got involved, how high did your confidence just shoot up?
Oh, it was amazing. I know you said I could swear, and I try not to in daily life, but literally we named her Kathleen fucking Turner because like, it's just, she's amazing. She's an icon. She's incredible. She is such a force of nature, and yet also so low maintenance. I mean, this woman should be the biggest diva because she's earned it, but she was Oh my God, she was so amazing to work with. She's so wonderful. I hadn't really, we'd been communicating because it's funny, you worked when you're working with someone of her stature or not. Like, you know, when you're working with talent, you generally have to observe like a certain amount of formality and go through agents and this kind of thing. And on set, it's a bit different. I didn't have to call her manager to find out how she'd like her coffee, but you know, there's that formality. And then just in the last couple of weeks, because of our TIFF premiere, and she was going to come up for it, and then she wasn't able to travel. And so I just wanted to reach out to her and say, just so you know, I know you missed the premiere, but I just want you to know how much people loved you, and how often I hear like you had Kathleen Packingtonner. And so I reached out to her directly, and now we talk on the phone a lot. And
That's awesome.
I go, I, you know, I was at a dinner on Friday night with some of my mentors and some of my colleagues out in Halifax, and I just sat down and my wristwatch starts buzzing, and I pick up my phone, and the phone says Kathleen Turner, and I'm like, just gonna take this, and I showed them who it was, and they're like, so that's like my pride and joy. How was she? How did we get her? We were pursuing this lovely actor for one of the male roles, and I spoke to his fantastic agent in LA, and we were getting on really well, and she read the script and she loved it. And it didn't work for timing with that actor, but in the meantime, this amazing agent, Julia Buchwald, has said to me, you know, because she'd read the script and loved it, and she said, you know, I handle Kathleen Turner. I was like, because it's a role that we wanted a big name for, and I felt going into this project that it was a really, the script as a whole was a really, had two really great roles for women who were at those points in Hollywood, in their careers, where Hollywood isn't necessarily looking to cast someone who's in their late 30s, and equally there's not necessarily all that many roles for women in their 60s. So I was, you know, hopeful that we would attract some major talent, and but we really hadn't figured out who it should be. And honestly, the idea of Kathleen was just beyond belief, and we didn't really quite believe that she would be interested in our little movie. But she read the script and she really connected to it. And again, all power to Kate. She had written such a beautiful script, and there were so many layers to the character of Bev. You know, it's the smallest of the lead roles in a way, in terms of scenes, but boy, does she make an impact. And her, yeah, she's just stunning in it. And like, of the movie's an emotional ride, and the romantic triangle is the heart of that. But there's three moments. I don't think I can say them because I think they may reveal too much, but there's three points in the movie where Kathleen does a look or says two words, and it stabs you in the heart and twists, and it's like, oh, okay. And it gets me every time. And she just has that ability. Her delivery is, her performance is exceptional, as they all are. But yeah, it was such a joy.
You
And
never
she
really
was.
like. Okay, what I really like is that you've interviewed. I mean, you've produced movies with some big names. The fact that you can still geek out over an actor is awesome.
100%, 1,000%. Yeah, I have. In fact, because I was an entertainment journalist, you're right. I have interviewed and I've produced movies with big names. But yeah, no, I'm 1,000% admiring of the actor's art. My dad, as part of the growing up in the theatre, he was adamant that I would not be acting. He used to sing this old music hall song called "Don't Put Your Daughter on the Stage, Mrs. Worthington," and he would sing that as a bedtime lullaby to me. So I was like very, very clear that I was not going to be on camera. And the funny thing is that I think, I mean, if I'd wanted to go into it, if I'd felt like that was my place, I would have 100% defied him, because I was as stubborn as he was. But it's not my thing, because I know people, the really truly talented actors have a way of just switching off their awareness of everything that's around them, except for the people in the scene, and I can't do that. I mean, when I was producing live TV, I had a great rapport with my reporters, and I would always, you know, get them ready, and then we'd roll camera, and we'd be chatting away, and then if they turned the camera on me, I would just freeze. I mean, I'm super self-conscious, and David has, I guess I've watched David act more than anyone else in the world, like directly seen him go from chat, joking around, keeping the set light and keeping everybody entertained, and then rolling, and then he's there and he's just focused on and having that switch is a real, it's a talent and an art. And so yeah, the pros are, they're always amazing to work with. It's really fun.
I can only imagine. And like I said, the people that you've worked with are truly amazing. I mean, I was obviously got Mr. Hewlett as well. It's awesome. So one thing I read recently about The Swearing Jar is that the United States rights were acquired by Gravitas Ventures.
That's right, yes.
So how impactful is that to the success of the film going forward? And does that mean it's going to get a wide release at some point so everyone can see it?
How quickly can you edit this? It comes out on Friday in the States. It's coming out in a limited theatrical. That's Friday, the 23rd of September. So it may be out by the time we use this. But it's a limited theatrical release starting on Friday, the 23rd, but with the potential to add cinemas in various cities. And it's on iTunes and all the... Oh, I get my VOD platforms all muddled up. Is it PVOD? Is that premium? Or is it S? No, SVOD is subscription. So you can buy it from Friday, or you can go to the cinema and see it on Friday. After that, there will be a window, and then it will be on the subscription platforms as well. Gravitas are amazing partners. They were here at the TIFF premiere, and they were at the dinner beforehand, and then they came to the movie, and then the next night we saw them as well, because we did our little after party the next day because it was a late screening. And they are super excited about it. We're super excited to work with them. We're, you know, dying to get the movie out there and have people see it however they see it. I mean, I'm platform agnostic. I enjoy movies at home. I enjoy movies at the cinema. I do think it's a movie that's worth paying attention to every detail. And the more focused you are, the better. So yeah, the theatrical experience is amazing. But equally, if you don't like to ugly cry in public, then feel free to go ahead and watch it on iTunes, because yeah, it's worth it. It's worth the ride. And it's also one of those movies that you see the first time and it has some surprises in it, and then you might want to go back and watch it again to try and catch us out. And I defy you to catch us out. I don't think we've made any mistakes. So in laying out the mapping out the stories. So yeah, let me know if I'm wrong.
So the listeners, go see it more than once.
Yes.
Ideally, three times is probably about right.
Yep, definitely. That sounds good to me. Go see it in the cinema, then you can watch it again at home on iTunes, and then treasure it forever on subscription. But yeah, it's just the US with Gravitas. We have a Canadian distributor level who we've been working with since the beginning, since I first started pitching it. So I believe it's coming out in Canada in mid to end of October. And then the rest of the world is going to follow suit as soon as they hear about
Awesome.
it.
So, what's next for you then, once this is all set?
Oh. Well, at some point, I'm going to hang the poster in my new office, and maybe get around to putting the house back to rights because we've been doing a bit of a reno at the same time as launching our movie. And then I just want to keep telling amazing stories about amazing women. So I've got a couple of scripts that I'm developing that are fiction, but really fun. And then there's a couple of true stories about amazing women that one day I want to tell their stories on screen. More action hero-y women. One is a woman who rowed across the Pacific, and the other is a woman who completed the Paris-Dakar. So motorbikes and boats are in my future, but before I get there, some more female-driven stories about messy women, because that's my favorite topic.
Well, that sounds awesome. So if when you're filming, if you film the one in across the Pacific Ocean, you're gonna film on the water?
Well, I guess we'd have to,
Well, I mean,
yeah.
versus I think I guess
Well, versus a tank.
I mean versus yeah, the tank versus actually going out there and doing it.
I think it would probably involve a bit of both, but certainly they start in San Francisco, they stop off in some Pacific islands, and they end up in Australia. So I'm perfectly happy to do all of those in the actual locations.
Very cool, very cool. So I wonder, did you become producers? You can go all these, you have an excuse to all these wonderful locations.
Well, both for my producing and also in David in following David's acting career, there's always an element of choice of is it art, money, or location? And yeah, I think I've been revising that recently and saying that the thing that I would add, but perhaps it's supersedes those three, would be heart and art and money and location. And things never really, I don't know that any project ever has actually satisfied all of those things. But that's certainly, the choices that, yeah, I mean, well, I'm super excited to be working on a project that we hope will shoot in New Zealand next year. And, could we have shot it elsewhere? Probably. But did we decide that we wanted to shoot it in New Zealand and sort of gone for that? Yes. Because it's just the most amazing place. Yeah, I definitely love the travel part of this job. But equally, as a producer based in Ontario, there are so many advantages to being based here and to working here, and amazing crews and amazing creatives and amazing benefits to being part of the Canadian system. So yeah, it's always a big
That
choice.
is awesome. I envy you going to New Zealand. I'm a big Lord of the Rings nerd, and that's where it was filmed. So I'm like,
Yes,
oh,
I know.
that's awesome.
We visited there because they're big into their conventions, their sci-fi comic cons and things. And so we've been lucky enough to go, I think, two or three times to New Zealand, and then four or five times to Australia, for conventions and for David, with David and with Stargate. And that's just been the most incredible experience. And so, yeah, I'm lucky enough to have seen. We didn't go to Hobbiton.
Uh-huh.
Don't know why. Not quite sure why. But I distinctly remember driving. We drove from Auckland to Wellington on the North Island. And there was a point where we were driving south around Rotorua, Tonga. It's a big lake, and you can see the volcanic range in the distance. Tongariro. Not sure exactly. I could look it up right now. But yeah, just seeing this amazing volcanic mountain range in the distance and thinking, yeah, this is Lord of the Rings country. But it's such an amazing mix of terrain. It's just, yeah, it's glorious.
Well, Lisa, that sounds absolutely awesome. And like I said, when these projects are ready, come back in the show. It has been an honor talking to you.
Thank you so much. It's been an honor talking to you. Thank you so much for inviting me. Yeah, anytime you have any questions, let me know. And I look forward to telling you all about the next movie when it's done.
That'd be awesome.
Hopefully less time than 6 years.
Well, my audience, go watch The Swearing Jar. It sounds awesome.
Thanks so much, Jeff. Lovely to meet you. Thank you. You too. Bye.